morning. This is Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm your host, Emily Nelson, and today I'll be talking with Sarah Foltz Jordan. Sarah is a pollinator conservation specialist for the Circe Society, and she'll be talking with us about pollinators. Thank you for joining me today, Sarah. Let's start off simple. What is a pollinator?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, when they think about pollinators or hear the word pollinators, they think about one bee, the European honeybee, which is a very important agricultural pollinator. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that we have, in North America, roughly 4,000 different kinds of native bees, not to mention all the other types of pollinators. And here in Minnesota, we have roughly 400 different kinds of native bees that are really important agricultural pollinators and also pollinators of our wildflowers as well. Looking more broadly at the term pollinator, that includes bees, wasps, butterflies, moths, flies, and what am I missing? Beetles. So lots of different types of pollinators. Bees are the most effective pollinator for most flowering plants, simply because of the way they collect a lot of pollen and bring it home to feed their offspring. So they have these bodies that are really well equipped to collect pollen and transfer that pollen around in the landscape.
Why are pollinators important?
You hear a lot and think a lot probably about how important pollinators are in our food systems. And many of your listeners have probably heard the statement that one in three bites of food that we eat, we can thank a pollinator for. And that's absolutely true, maybe even an understatement. I think there's less attention towards how important our pollinators are in natural areas. So our wetlands, our woodlands, our prairies are all also very pollinator dependent. Around 85% of flowering plants depend on a pollinator to transfer pollen and effectively allow that plant to set seed.
So then the plants that don't rely on pollinators, instead they rely on wind, right?
Yeah, and most of what we're eating that is not pollinator dependent are like our grains. Most grasses are wind pollinated.
What are the main differences between the domesticated honeybee and the wild bees?
So differences between the honeybees and the wild bees. The wild bees are very, very diverse. So there's all different kinds. There's bumblebees, there's sweat bees, there's mason bees. And I guess one of the key differences is that the honeybees are managed by humans. They nest in boxes, you know, that we provide for them, whereas the native bees have to find not only all the food that they need in the wild, but also safe places to nest. And most of our native bees nest in the ground. So they need, you know, well-drained, you know, it's often bare ground that's protected from pesticides and pesticide drift. And then the remainder of our native bees, for the most part, nest in, like, hollow cavities in stems or wood. So they need those types of shrubs and larger statured prairie plants around.
Is there a way that people can get involved in assessing wild bee populations?
Yeah, we have a really fun citizen science project called Bumblebee Watch. And basically what we're asking people to do is simply take pictures of any bumblebees that they see, and good pictures, you know, close up as you can. And then submit them to this website called Bumblebee Watch. And it's a very user-friendly interface where you can put in your picture, a dot on the map indicating the location where you found it. It will then narrow down the list of bumblebees that it could be just based on your location. And then you can further narrow it down by selecting different attributes that you see. Like it had orange hairs or it had, you know, whatever you can see, you can indicate that. And it will further narrow it down until you finally arrive at an ID for your bee. And then we have experts around the country who are verifying those IDs. And all of this information feeds into this database that's helping us better understand bumblebee distribution across North America and conservation status and conservation needs. And here in Minnesota, it's especially exciting to do this work because we have about six different species that are at risk of extinction, including One, the Rusty Patch Bumblebee, which has just been petitioned for Endangered Species Act listing. And it's still hanging on in Minnesota, but any records are really, really important.
Are there photos on the website that people can use to identify bees?
Yeah, Bumblebee Watch has a lot of photos. I would also maybe point you to Elaine Evans' website. I'm forgetting what her website is called, but anyway, it's more of a Minnesota-focused bumblebee website.
Oh, okay.
I think it's called the Minnesota Bumblebee Survey.
I can check the details on that, and I can add it at the end of the show. What are the biggest challenges that are facing pollinators right now?
All pollinators, and maybe more broadly speaking, we could talk about wildlife in general, but are faced with this threat of habitat loss. So we have dramatically altered the natural ecosystems across our state and nation, and you know, we've lost 99.9% of our prairies. Our forested areas are dramatically impacted by invasive species, and with that comes, you know, consequences for things like our pollinators that depend on a lot of these natural resources. So habitat loss is a big one. Pesticide exposure is another key threat. A lot of the chemicals that are used in our, you know, modern agriculture are really problematic for pollinators. You hear a lot about neonicotinoids, and they're insecticide that's used as a seed treatment for corn and soy, among many other things. But they were originally thought to be sort of a low-risk solution, but the way they work is that they're systemic, so they move from the seed coating or from the soil into all the tissue of the plant, including the pollen and nectar. So there is this direct route of exposure for pollinators and other flower visitors. And it turns out they're highly toxic to insects. So to these insects that are really beneficial to agriculture in so many ways. So neonicotinoids are a big one. And there's a lot of momentum in Minnesota to try to curb their use, both in ornamental situations and in our large-scale agricultural systems. Disease is another issue that's been, you know, pretty well studied, especially with regard to honeybee decline, but also an issue with some native bees as well.
What kind of impact do invasive species have on pollinators?
The problem with invasive species, there are many problems with invasive species, but one that stands out to me is just how quickly they displace a diversity of plants. And diversity is important because insects have a tremendous diversity, and a lot of insects are closely linked to one or a few certain plants. And if you lose that diversity, especially things like moths and butterflies, they can be really picky eaters, and they might feed on aspen, but they won't feed on buckthorn. So you can't just replace one green plant with another. You know, there's all these plant compounds that influence what insects can eat what plant.
How about climate change? What kind of impacts do you think that that might have on pollinators?
Yeah, climate change is an interesting one, especially I think about climate change probably the most with regard to bumblebees, because they are a group of animals that they tend to be more northern in distribution. Here in Minnesota, we have 18 species. In the southern states, you know, some of those states have just a few different kinds of bumblebees. So they're one of few animal groups that actually increases in diversity as you move up in latitude. They love northern climates. And many of them are already sort of at their montane high elevation species that, as the climate warms, they really have nowhere to go. So that's a concern. And then also for all pollinators, kind of how climate change is impacting phenology of plants and when plants bloom, and how, you know, how well plants and pollinators are going to be able to maintain this relationship where they're in sync with each other is a concern.
I've been thinking a lot about that this winter. We had such a warm burst of weather early on, and then it really cooled down after a while.
Exactly. And you can get a lot of insect emergence only to have terrible weather come after.
Can you talk a little bit about monarchs?
Monarchs are you know, very well-loved, charismatic insects that have been pretty well-studied for the last several decades. And are gaining a lot of attention in recent years for how severely their populations have declined. So since the 90s, the population decline has been roughly on the order of 80%. Population size is typically monitored down in Mexico in terms of the amount of area that the overwintering monarch population covers. So that area has been shrinking. And I guess one of the key issues driving that is not what's going on in Mexico, although there are issues there too, but rather what's happening up here in their breeding ground. And this again is where that habitat loss comes into play, because so much of the monarch's only food plant, milkweed, has been eliminated from our landscape with the increasing use of Roundup Ready crops. So milkweed used to grow well in disturbed agricultural fields. Now it's not present, except sometimes on field borders, and that's really driven this shrinking population. But there's a lot of efforts underway right now to try to bring that milkweed back and incorporate milkweed anywhere we can in our yards, in our roadsides, in our farms, in our gardens.
For folks who want to plant milkweed in their yard, is there a specific kind of milkweed that's preferred?
Yeah, there's quite a few different kinds of milkweed. The common milkweed, as far as I understand, is one of the best at supporting monarchs, but they will also, the larvae will feed on butterfly weed, on swamp milkweed, and then milkweeds in general are amazing nectar plants for adult monarchs and for all kinds of other beneficial insects. Mm-hmm. So yeah, milkweeds are amazing. And there's quite a few that are commercially available. Like, you can actually go out and purchase them from a native seed company.
Do you have any suggestions as far as what people can do to improve the situation for pollinators?
Yeah, I mean, something that all of us can do is plant flowers, you know, even a window box, even a pot. Mm-hmm. But obviously the more, the better, the more diverse, the better, and go native whenever you can. Native plants have a really, really long and amazing relationship with the native pollinators that support them, and it's amazing for me to see. I've grown annuals for many years, non-native annuals. And when I first started planting these annual flowers, it was amazing how many insects started visiting them. But then as I gradually transitioned those gardens into native wildflowers, it was like orders of magnitude more insects coming to visit those flowers. And I've just been totally blown away with like all the diversity of insects that are out there. So planting flowers, avoiding pesticides, you know, so protecting whatever flowers you plant from pesticides, and asking at your local nurseries when you buy plants if those plants have been treated with neonics. Mm-hmm. Just to, continue to raise awareness on these issues.
Is that a common practice that people need to be aware of?
It is a common, unfortunately, common practice. Yeah, and nurseries might not know right off the bat if the plants have been treated, because there are some issues with traceability. But there are some nurseries who have committed to being neonic-free. So seek out those nurseries if you can.
And I've heard you mention protecting nesting habitat.
Yeah, protecting nesting habitat is a good one, too. It's a little bit harder to see your efforts working. But if you have the space, I encourage everybody to plant native shrubs. So things like elderberry, highbush cranberry, willows, dogwoods. A lot of our native shrubs, juneberries are another great one for your region. But a lot of our native shrubs bloom early, so they're providing really critical early season food for these bees that are emerging. And then they often have like hollow or pithy stems that other bees can nest in. And some of them, like the juneberry, have food for us as well. So it's win-win-win.
I'm just going to interrupt quickly to remind everyone, you're listening to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWHLP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. I'm talking today with Sarah Foltz-Jordan, a pollinator conservation specialist with the Circe Society. And we're talking about pollinators. Sarah, can you describe the life cycle of wild bees?
Yeah, it varies. I can tell you about bumblebees in particular. So Bumblebees are a social insect, kind of like honeybees. So they have a queen, they have workers, and then they have males. And right about now, so early spring, the only bumblebees that are out there in the landscape are new queens that were born last summer and mated last summer, but then spent the winter, you know, in leaf litter or underground, kind of waiting for spring. So right now, those new queens are emerging, and their first priority is to find a new nest. And so they're seeking out nests and also feeding on these early spring blooms, building up some resources, provisioning that new nest with pollen and nectar, and then they lay eggs on that pollen and nectar. And that first batch of eggs, she strategically controls the sex of those offspring such that they're all females. And so all of those new offspring are her female worker bees, and then they take over those duties of foraging and caring for the young in the hive. And she spends more of her time on strictly laying more eggs and staying inside the nest. And then as the summer wears on, the population size within the hive builds up, and eventually the queen starts making males and making new queens, and they leave the hive, mate, and then the whole thing kind of starts over. But
is our original queen going to be still alive and working the next year?
No. Yeah, in the fall, everybody dies. The old queen dies, the males die, and the workers die. And the only, you know, cast, I guess, that's carrying on this next generation is that new queen. So, yeah, there's a lot hinging on those bumblebee queens. And I guess that speaks to the importance of, you know, leaving some habitat for that type of insect in your landscape. So leaving a messy yard is a good yard. Leave leaf litter around, branches around, brush around, rock piles, all that stuff is important for not just bees, but lots of other things as well.
Another thing I've heard you talk about is voting with your dollar.
I mean, that's another thing that everybody can do. We all eat food, and we have a tremendous amount of power, I think, in choosing food that is more friendly to these wild animals that we care about and that we depend so much on.
Is organic farming healthier for pollinators?
I guess I didn't really explain what I do at Xerces, but I work in the pollinator program primarily on farms and helping farmers to put in habitat for pollinators. And it's really amazing working with, we work with all types of farmers, but a lot of the organic growers that we work with, it's just so much easier because we don't have to worry about some of these drift concerns, and we can put habitat right up against their crops and be really assured that it's a safe place for insects to live. And then there's a lot of other things that go into not just organic farms, but sustainable farms in general, like strategies that focus on soil health and, you know, using things like cover crops and crop rotation to limit pest outbreaks in the first place and make your crops more resilient and, you know, protect a variety of wildlife in that way also.
What is your position within Xerces Society?
Yeah, so I work as a pollinator conservation specialist for the Xerces Society, and I work primarily in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, helping farmers to create and enhance habitat for pollinators and for other beneficial insects in pest control. So a lot of the farmers that I work with are maybe growing pollinator-dependent crops and really need pollinators around for that reason, but some of them are even more interested in attracting the other beneficial insects like lacewings and hoverflies and spiders and ground beetles and, you know, things that are so important in natural pest control on farms, and especially on organic farms where they're not using insecticides to manage pests. They're really relying on the good bugs to fight the bad bugs. And habitat helps with that because these insects need lots of other resources beyond food. You know, they need a place to nest. Sometimes they need alternative food like flower nectar to feed on.
Can you describe what the Xerces Society is?
Yeah, so the Xerces Society is a nonprofit conservation organization focused on the protection of invertebrates and their habitats. And invertebrates, that includes, pollinators, which is one of our key focuses, but also things like freshwater mussels and terrestrial snails. And we tend to focus a lot on some of the most at-risk and imperiled animal groups.
Is it national?
Yes, we are a national organization based in Portland, Oregon, but we have regional staff nationwide. I'm here in Minnesota, and we also have another staff person in Minnesota and someone in Wisconsin now and Nebraska. So that's kind of our Midwest team. But And then we have four programs, an endangered species program doing a lot of work to protect freshwater mussels and bumblebees and other at-risk groups, doing a lot of work on monarchs now as well. We have an aquatics program doing work with things like mosquito management and another citizen science project that I haven't mentioned yet called Pond Watch, but it's looking at migratory dragonflies and harnessing the power of citizens to kind of better understand what's going on with that phenomenon. We have a pesticide program doing work to support farmers and policymakers and other interested groups in decisions surrounding pesticide use and mitigation and regulation. And then we have our pollinator program, which is our biggest program. That's the program that I work for. And we are primarily doing work with farmers, helping them to design and install habitat and doing work in roadway systems as well. And lots of outreach and training events and yeah.
What is the scale of the work that you do?
Okay. So since 2008, our pollinator program has led to the creation of more than 245,000 acres of pollinator habitat. And we've conducted hundreds of workshops and short courses on native pollinators, training over 60,000 people in these ideas surrounding pollinator protection and habitat creation.
Where can people find more information about what your organization does and how to protect pollinators?
Yeah, I would definitely check out the Xerces website. So it's www.xerces.org, and you spell Xerces X-E-R-C-E-S. And on that website, you can find a tremendous number of resources ranging from fact sheets about, plants that will support these pollinators, what plants are really rock stars for pollinators in this region. So a lot of regional information. There is information about farming for pollinators and incorporating pollinators into more urban settings or roadsides. There's a lot of information about pest management using these more natural methods and promoting some of the other beneficial insects I was talking about earlier. Lots of information on the monarch as well. So yeah, our website is xerces.org.
What do you find most rewarding in your work?
So I really like working at this intersection of farming and conservation, and it's kind of amazing to me to have the privilege of working with so many farmers who are really able to not compromise their production, yet still grow food in a way that's compatible with the success of bees and other wildlife. And a great example of a farm that I work closely with that's doing this in a pretty big way is this grain farm out in Montana. And these guys are growing, this is Villicus Farms, they're growing around 4,700 acres of organic grains and oilseed crops in a rotation and incorporated with a lot of different cover crops. But they're not using insecticides. They're not using herbicides. They're not using synthetic fertilizer. And I've been working with them to incorporate pollinator habitat in all of their fields. So we're putting in about 30-foot wide strips that run the lengths of the field, and they're planted in diverse native wildflowering habitat. And this habitat is not only supporting pollinators, but they've also found lots of other benefits associated with having this habitat as well, including you know, reduced weed invasion into their crop fields. The habitat is tall and it's capturing snowdrift, which is bringing more moisture onto their fields. They're serving as corridors for wildlife. Last time I was out there, we saw pronghorn, you know, running through the farm. Yeah, so they're also supporting insects that are important in pest control. There's so many good things about bringing habitat into the farm, and there's amazing ways to do this that are compatible with production.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Sarah. And thank you all for joining us here on Conservation Corner. During our interview, Sarah mentioned Elaine Evans as a good source of more information about pollinators. Elaine is an entomologist and the captain of the Wild Bee Squad at the University of Minnesota's Bee Lab. She is the co-author of Befriending Bumblebees, and you can learn more information about this book at befriendingbumblebees.com. The University of Minnesota Bee Lab also has its own website with a ton of information about bees and planting for pollinators, and you can find that at beelab.umn.edu. And then, as Sarah said, you can also find out more information on the Circe Society website, which is circes.org. And Circes is spelled X-E-R-C-E-S. I would like to announce an event that Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District will be putting on next month in partnership with the City of Two Harbors and Castle Danger Brewery. We'll be hosting the second annual Sweep the Skunk, a creek cleanup event right here in Two Harbors, and it will take place on Saturday, June 25th, from 9:30 a.m. until 12:30. And volunteers will spend a couple of hours picking up trash along Skunk Creek, which runs through downtown Two Harbors, and then we'll hold a small celebration afterwards at Castle Danger Brewery. You can find out more information about the event on the Lake County SWCD website and also on our Facebook page. On the next episode of Conservation Corner, I'll be talking to Lake County Environmental Services Manager Christine McCarthy about recycling and hazardous waste disposal in Lake County. We hope you'll tune in. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to Conservation Corner here on 99.5 FM, KTWH-LP, Two Harbors, Minnesota. Conservation Corner is produced by Lake County Soil and Water Conservation District with funds from the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment. I'm Emily Nelson, and I hope you have a wonderful afternoon.